Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for tuning in to the conversation on this Aloha Friday, June 14th. Another solar farm goes online. We told you about one on Maui. This one is on Oahu, and it will help to power both the military and the local community. We look at home ownership in Hawaii. Sales are down as interest rates are high. A local entrepreneur and podcaster shares what local people should be doing to be able to buy a home here. And we'll hear how a Maui High School is helping to launch students toward a career in aerospace. Plus, ukuleles for Lahaina, an inaugural music event, kicks off next week. Organizers plan to take the concert on the road. Tune to the conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It has been quite a week for the Navy with some good and not so good news. First, the positive headlines. A new solar project on military land is now online and generating green energy. The Navy also turned over 300 acres of unused property in West Oahu to the city and county for recreational use, possibly a racetrack. All this happening after inadvertently releasing a copy of its public relations strategy with the community to a journalist. In it, the Navy outlined the need to balance media coverage from the 1 out of 12 positive to negative stories to 1 out of 4. It included talking points about the military's need to rebuild trust and its commitment to protect the environment, as well as working closely with regulators. The latest negative headlines includes news that the Environmental Protection Agency is reconsidering the future of the Red Hill Community Representation Initiative Advisory Group. It was born out of the Red Hill fuel spills. The CRI has been at odds with the Navy and the EPA over the use of a federal mediator during the meetings. And we'll get back to that part, but back to the positive news. All this week, we have been looking at new green energy projects in the state. A new 42-megawatt solar project on Oahu is officially online. It is the first large-scale facility with batteries out Ebba Beach Way. Kupono Solar is the first project on military land that will go toward generating power for the community as well as a military base. Meredith Berger is the Navy's Assistant Secretary for the Energy Installations and Environment. She spoke with us following the blessing of the project yesterday afternoon.
This project is actually resilience for the entire community. It's pretty neat. It's Navy land combined with some technical experts from Ameresco who know how to generate this energy for solar to bring in some of the infrastructure. And what this means is 42 megawatts of solar energy and battery storage across about 131-acre site of land. And this means that the energy is going back to the grid now so that there is energy to support mission for the Navy. There's energy to support all of the health, safety, welfare that comes with the community. And no matter what, it's collective resilience. And so it's a pretty exciting day.
And so are you folks doing this anywhere else where you've got some redundancy built in?
In terms of this type of authority, it's one that is a really good way to make sure that we're using our land in the highest and best use. And so this application is the first in what will be a series. So coming down the pike, and this is something that's shared about in terms of a more comprehensive laydown of projects, we'll look to use more of the Navy land, Joint Base Pearl Harbor, ICOM, to be able to create more renewable energy. And these will be firm renewable and battery energy storage and start to really build out what this means for the energy ecosystem. And so this energy is going to be redundant, as you note, but also renewable and kind of hardened and protected so that when we see different kinds of threats come in, whether it's a storm, a wildfire, anything that may impact the infrastructure, it's actually protected so that people can have that reliable energy when they need it.
So you'll have a total of 3 solar projects up there?
So both of them have solar combined with some battery storage as well.
we should note that, you know, this has been a big week. And earlier in the week, you made an announcement with Honolulu Mayor Rick Blangiardi about the transfer of military lands to the city and county.
Yes, that's right. And this is something that started decades ago and really got some momentum just a few years ago. And so this is under the BRAC program. So BRAC is Base Realignment and Closure. But what this does is it helps Navy Mission, because land that's not being utilized goes to a place that it can be optimized and utilized, which creates both relief for Mission and really good benefits for the community. So it was about 2 years ago that we realized that with $6 million, we could tip the first domino to start to revitalize the Kalaeloa area. And it took some energy tenants being transferred from old infrastructure to new. And from there, Hawaii Homelands and everyone really could start to look at how to improve the community there through more recreational space, through more green space. And so that's what those 400 acres are going to go towards. And the mayor noted that, but after 2 years of hard work from the city, from the Navy team, from the National Park Service, who is helping with this as well, the Kalaeloa community should be able to see some really good returns on this recreational space.
And these are two really good news stories. Our friends over at Honolulu Civil Beat did a story about a public relations strategy on how to regain trust in the community, you know, after Red Hill, and to better improve the military's image, because it has gotten a black eye in recent years with the fuel spill.
These are two examples of things that we've been working for years, and these are the types of things that will continue to work, because when you're part of a community, you do the best that you can to make sure that you are working with partners, staying committed to shared values and yielding the outcomes that will create the most co-benefits for everybody involved, because that's what community is. And so for something that's years in the making, and we will have more things that will come with more years, we'll keep doing the right thing, because the right thing is always the right thing to do.
Is there anything else you can share with us on the Red Hill piece of this?
Absolutely, making sure that we are focused on all of the regulatory requirements that are out there. This is a very technical process, of course, and so working with all the regulators to make sure that we are responsive to questions, meeting the regulatory requirements that they have set out, and developing solutions so that we remain on plan. This is a novel concept to be able to close a facility of this size. It's one that the Navy takes seriously. Safety is the priority, and making sure that we do this quickly in an informed way and completely. The closure of Red Hill remains the number one task for the closure task force, and they are meeting that mission every single day. And so that is how the closure task force is working right now for Red Hill.
And it sounds like the venting is going along pretty well, you know, so far.
Yes, the venting is going along, and in terms of air quality monitoring and all of the other requirements that are there, we have been working with the Department of Health to make sure that ventilation and all of the other information that they have requested is coming in as it should. And I'll note that with our app, we've got the hourly reporting up, and that was one of the requirements that the Department of Health stated for ventilation, and making sure that we were communicating that information clearly with the community. It is on the website, and they continue to demonstrate very low levels, and so we are happy that we're monitoring to show that consistently we're in a good place.
And, you know, we've just learned that the EPA plans to dismantle or disband the Community Representation Initiative. What can you say about that? Because, you know, there may be some concern that the members have that they're not being heard.
And yes, saw that the EPA made that announcement on the Community Representation Initiative. And first and foremost, we are looking to get inputs from the community, share information clearly. And while the CRI was one forum that created that opportunity, as EPA noted in their announcement, it was not a productive forum. And so we need to make sure that we are clearly connecting with the community members that we're getting information out to them in a timely and clear fashion, and also receiving those inputs. With the variety of forums that we have the opportunity both to create and participate in, whether it's public gatherings, neighborhood board meetings, any of the other places that we're able to engage, we'll continue to look forward to get those inputs from the community because they're valuable, because they help our team to think better, act better, because it gives us an informed perspective. And then also make sure that we continue to put information out through the app, through websites, through press releases, through every opportunity that we have to share that information so that the community is clear about what is going on with a very important activity within their environment.
But do you worry that the disbanding of the CRI group might backfire? I mean, if you're trying to build community trust and then this group is kind of cut out of the process?
These individuals can always come to any of these forums. They can always provide feedback. They can always be included in public information sessions. And so while it eliminates a forum, it does not eliminate people. And so I am not worried that we'll not have that input because there are so many places that people have the opportunity to come speak directly with our Navy team who's working hard to make sure that they are safely and efficiently closing Red Hill.
We were talking to Meredith Berger, the Navy's Assistant Secretary for the Energy Installations and the Environment. The EPA did release a statement late yesterday acknowledging that it met with CRI members Wednesday and told them about possibly disbanding the group. It had briefed Hawaii's congressional staff back in March about the lack of progress on the ground rules of future meetings. And there is some dispute about whether the delegation supports the elimination of the advisory group. CR Chair Marty Townsend told HPR that the EPA indicated at its meeting it planned to send a letter notifying them formally of its intent to amend the work order and do away with the CRI. Townsend says its next meeting is for next week, Thursday. Stay tuned to see who may or may not attend.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
Each week, New Dimensions explores the social, political, scientific, environmental, and spiritual frontiers with some of today's foremost social innovators, thinkers, scientists, and creative artists.
Hi, I'm Alanis Morissette. Next time on New Dimensions, I'll be talking about various versions of service in the world and how we can show up as our truest selves to serve.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
The median sale price of a single-family home in Hawaii is up from a year ago and hovering around $1 million, according to the Locations Hawaii website. It is one of the many reasons the state has stepped up efforts to increase affordable housing. But with interest rates and the cost of living on the rise, middle-class Hawaii families may wonder if owning a home in our islands will ever be in their reach. Brooks Onishi is an Oahu entrepreneur with decades of experience in the real estate and mortgage industry. He's also the host of the Real Hawaii Talk podcast, where he discusses real estate, among other topics. And since this happens to be National Home Ownership Month, HPR's Russell Subiono invited Onishi into their studios to talk about the barriers to owning a home.
What are you seeing in terms of the Hawaii home ownership market right now?
This would be the second time I've experienced a full cycle in the market. Like, you experience the growth, the uptick, the build of equity, mm-hmm. right? Everybody's buying and the prices are just continuing to inflate. And then in 2007, 2008, that was the first downturn I experienced personally while mm-hmm. still in the industry. Now we're back here. It rose, it climbed to where it's at. And then we're kind of in this holding pattern a little bit, right? But it's just a weird spot. Like, people are still buying, the really smart ones that aren't hindered by like qualifications or all these other things that, you know, may be an obstacle for other people. The other ones that don't necessarily have the ability or are on the verge of that, I think they're letting fear take over a little bit. So there's a lot of skepticism, and it's really hard to quantify what's going to happen. We've been waiting for rates to come down, and in direct proportion to what's happening with inflation numbers. We were hoping for a drop in March. That didn't happen. Now we're looking at 2 rate cuts before the end of the year, potentially. I'm hopeful that one will actually take place this year. But it's just one of those things that you can't really quantify where it's going to be in the future. You don't know what the key indicators are going to do to, you know, make a little bump here, and then that just throws everything off its current trajectory. It's just, you can't forecast it at all.
You mentioned everything's kind of in a holding pattern right now. I know that when median sale prices hit $1 million, that freaked a lot of people out, mm-hmm. right? And I feel like that just kind of amped up a lot of fear that local people had about being able to buy a home or to buy property. And like you said, people are still buying. I think a lot of middle-class local people feel that it's impossible to buy a home now. Is it impossible?
No, it's not. It may be impossible if you're still constraining yourself within that mindset of limiting beliefs. I set my own boundaries. What I think about is impossible becomes possible. Now, are these things what we grew up in? What everybody else is talking about? 100%. That's why we believe them, because this is the same constraint that everybody else is living in. Mm-hmm. Are they impossible? No. You're running with the wrong crowd. You want to do things that you've never done before. You got to go run with people you've never run with before. And so that's what I did, is I changed who I was hanging out with. I changed who was feeding into my mindset, even just down to the background noise, right? It all counts. It all contributes to some sort of feeling, thought process, your overall just direction.
So for like local people that are hoping to buy a home in the near future, it sounds like changing your mindset is part of the process of being able to start down that road of home ownership. What are some of the most important things local people should be doing to start down that road of home ownership?
Well, I think first and foremost, for a lot of just the average person, local or not, anywhere in the U.S., it's a matter of just the basics, budgeting your credit score, and being in a position, you know, what those factors are that the bank is going to look for to qualify you for a loan. You got to understand those things. If you've never talked to a loan officer before, gotten pre-approved, how do you know you qualify or not? And that's like the biggest thing that I'll probably come across is, have you talked to somebody yet to get pre-qualified? No. How come? Oh, because I know my credit's not good enough. How do you know that? Are you a loan officer, right? Did somebody tell you your credit's not good enough? No. So you're speculating. They'd rather feed into that fear of, I know I'm not good enough, so I'm not going to go there, try to apply and get rejected for the fear of rejection. But rejection just means you found out exactly what it takes to get qualified, because they just told you, here's where you're at, here's where you need to be. And still, that conversation is uncomfortable for a lot of people. So it's hard to break out of that barrier and get into the uncomfortable for most.
So you can turn that rejection into a positive if you're willing to change your mindset and willing to take that first step forward, right?
That rejection can become a projection.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk to you about your podcast, Real Hawaii Talk, where you have these great discussions about homeownership and real estate, among a multitude of other subjects that you also cover that is relevant to life in Hawaii. How have your podcast guests broaden your view or broaden your understanding of home ownership or real estate in Hawaii? Do they give you some perspectives that you hadn't thought of before?
Most definitely. And I think I get that from any individual that I talk to, whatever we're talking about. I'm always trying to get feedback. Like my biggest question, my number one question I always want to ask somebody is, what do you do for a living, right? I'm trying to figure out what I want to do when I grow up, right? To this day. So what do you do? Like, why? Are you happy? You know, what do you get out of that? So just trying to see through somebody else's lens. So it's the same with any topic, homeownership, what challenges they're facing. Majority of the guests on my podcast have been entrepreneurs. A lot of them are from blue collar background or even white collar, but just not the professional setting. And they've gotten into real estate investing and just figuring out how to make it work. So I started it as it was kind of a hack for me to get into the real estate investing community, because I come from the retail side of real estate sales and the mortgage industry. But what they're doing is completely different. So it is a mindset shift that I think only now retail realtors, mortgage professionals are trying to wrap their heads around. I saw it coming, so I was an early adopter.
And that's one of the reasons why I was really interested in talking to you, because I feel like you have a broader perspective on the real estate industry here than probably most people.
Well, I jokingly say my whole life, only because when everybody else got picked up from school and went home to ride bike, I went to the real estate office. My grandmother had a real estate office that she had built, primarily property management, but that was in order to retain all of her clients. Then my mom followed suit after that, and I didn't think, hey, this is what I want to be when I grow up. But in 2004, I ended up getting my real estate license, and that was the beginning of the professional career for me. Yeah. But really growing up in that household, you know, I was already groomed for it, you know? So got my license in 2004, started working with my mom. She was a partner and still is a partner at locations and did sales, property management throughout most of that time period. And then in 2015, I saw a niche that I thought I really could associate with and talk story with. And it was the military at that time. VA loans had become really popular. They were more stigmatic prior to that. And I could just have these conversations. Most of these applicants were the ones that were applying for my rentals. So why not apply for a home loan? And so it was just one of those things. Like I'm always looking for, okay, what is the horizon telling me? What's on the horizon? And for me, it was, I didn't get as much gratification out of helping homeowners purchase homes from the realtor side. I got way more gratification and a better human interaction with individuals as a loan officer. And so that is the main reason why I did it. I'm not a mathematician. I'm great at using a calculator. And if it wasn't for that, I wouldn't have a job. But I'm good with people. And the numbers part of it is the scariest part for them. The first thing that every individual does is they go online and they're window shopping. So the shopping for the home and looking for the home, that's the exciting part. That is not the hard part. The hard part is qualifying for it. All the stuff that we want to run away from screaming, that's what we got to do first.
Like we mentioned earlier, June is National Home Ownership Month. Do you have a cool story or do you have a favorite story of how you were able to help a local person get into a home?
I have a local couple that they were on Oahu and we were able to get them a home on the Big Island. It wasn't a quick process. This family wasn't that easy slam dunk transaction. And it took a little while. I think when we initially talked, I'm thinking maybe it was in like 2018. And then maybe like a whole year later, they kind of came back around and said, okay, we're ready now. They had to make some changes from employment from here to Big Island, wait for the opportunity for a transfer, stuff like that. And we were able to get them a home up there right before all of this big influx of focus on the Hilo side of the Big Island. And the coolest part about the story is that they got a home, yes. As I started to focus and put myself out there more in the real estate investing community, we actually connected there. So they came back around and are involved in a circle of people on the Big Island that I network with and part of my circle. And they're now involved on that side, helping that community get more educated with financial literacy. To see them go from purchasing their home, becoming homeowners, to now they're members in the community trying to help educate other people side by side with me, that was the thing that I kind of got, you know, like chicken skin on.
Brooks Onishi, thanks so much for your time today, man. Always a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It was an honor.
That was Oahu entrepreneur Brooks Onishi talking about home ownership in Hawaii with HPR's Russell Subiono. Onishi is also the host of the Real Hawaii Talk podcast, which you can find on YouTube.
It's easy to suffer from information overload these days. Social media posts that just keep scrolling, bite-sized headlines sent to your phone and even your watch. I'm Ira Flatow. Every week on Science Friday, we take a step back for a longer look into the big ideas in science. Take a deeper dive with us. It's all on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
This week's performance at HPR's Hawaii Jazz Performance Series is sold out. Mahalo for your support. Watch videos from past HPR concerts and sign up for email alerts for future performances. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org, sponsored by Farm Lovers Markets.
Now to take a look at our mailbox and hear feedback from listeners. The topic of feral cats and their impact on native species has been filling our inbox after a couple of stories we aired last month. We got this email from Doug in Kailua Kona that said in part, "Unfortunately, your show this morning left listeners with some misinformation and mistaken impressions that because toxo is not the leading cause of nene deaths, it is not a major problem. Toxo can infect many other organisms and has killed numerous spinner dolphins and monk seals in Hawaii. Toxo may not pose a major threat to the survival of nene, but it does for the Hawaiian monk seal, a critically endangered endemic species so rare that every individual is vital to the population. Toxo also infects humans. The consequences are poorly understood, yet there are correlations between markers of toxo infection and all sorts of outcomes from frequency of auto accidents to schizophrenia." Bobby from the Big Island sent in this email. "The problem is cats. Feral cats are not part of any native ecosystem. They eat native birds, decimating albatross colonies, killing endangered uahu on our mountains. If they aren't contained, they'll still eat birds and make kukai all over. Bottom line, protect Malama, our native species. Native, not introduced." And finally, we got this email from Sheila. "A lot of these cats are dumped when people leave the island, especially the military. That is the root of our problem right there. It's never going to end unless you stop people from leaving their pets. A lot of them are not fixed, so more kittens come along. Can you help raise money for a cat sanctuary? I know there are many cat lovers who would work hard on getting it together and taking care of it. All we need is a land to put one on. If you have questions or comments regarding a story on our show, let us know. Call the talkback line, leave a voicemail, 808-792-8217, or send an email to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Unihoa, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, oahu, umolokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhawaii.
This morning we delve through the archives to test you on a public works project that holds the record as the longest tunnel in the islands. In November of 1994, the structure was named in honor of the longtime State Highways employee who oversaw construction. He worked for over 50 years before retiring as the State Highways Administrator. However, less than a decade later, the Cayetano administration changed the name and caused some controversy. Governor Cayetano had the original signage removed and replaced with brass letters that read John A. Burns Tunnel, honoring Hawaii's second governor. Not everyone was happy with that decision, and supporters of the tunnel's original name gathered 10,000 signatures to change it back. When Governor Linda Lingle took office, she did just that. So for today's backyard quiz, can you give us the name that's found above the entrance to this spectacular two-way tunnel today? Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And pick up a reusable HPR tote bag if you're the first one to get it right.
Mm-hmm.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, supporting nonprofits such as the Molokai Affordable Housing Alliance, providing Kupuna with resources for building affordable homes on Molokai. NareitHawaii.com.
Maui High School students have teamed up with NASA and the University of Hawaii to test some theories about space, the new frontier. HBR reporter Catherine Kluwet-Pachtel got a chance to talk to some of our young budding scientists. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
So you had a fun story.
I did. Four Maui High School students, as you said, with the guidance of University of Hawaii professors, have created an experiment to measure how plastic degrades under ultraviolet light. And I feel like I need to put a disclaimer in here because talking to these students, I mean, their understanding of science is really mind-blowing, and I hope that I do justice to explaining their project as a non-science person. But their experiment was selected by the Cubes in Space program, which is in partnership with NASA. It's a competitive international opportunity for students to send their experiments on a high-altitude NASA balloon flight. And that'll be happening later this summer. But the trick is the experiments have to fit in a 4x4x4 centimeter cube. So it's a really tiny space that the selected students have to fit their entire project into. And the balloon will be up for, I think it's between 5 and 15 hours or something like that. It's not exact, you know, dependent on weather and other factors. But these Maui students will be testing high exposure to UV over a short period of time. So as the students will explain, the ozone layer up higher is less dense than we have down low. And so by sending plastics up into suborbital space, they will be evaluating how ultraviolet light affects that plastic, how much it degrades, how quickly it degrades. And after the balloon flight, the experiment will be returned to the students, and they will measure the amount of methane that plastic off-gassed during the flight under various filtration conditions. And they'll be comparing it to the same experiment on Earth here at our surface level. I spoke with three students on the team, and here we listen to Joshua Mori and Holden Suzuki, who are both rising seniors at Maui High, explain the project.
Our experiment really just tried to seek how the ultraviolet radiation can degrade plastic in a specific controlled environment and see how much of UV will affect degradation and just see in different like settings and different variables that we do apply to it to see like where one might, you know, degrade more and one might degrade less, or one may be the same. And we're trying to figure out where this issue and how we can apply this further.
It's also an experiment that tests how well our environment can handle UV radiation. Because as you might have heard, the ozone layer is getting a little bit weaker and some areas of it are actually letting more UV in, right? So as that UV gets stronger and stronger, we're going to notice more plastic degradation. So our goal is to see how much faster does this plastic degrade and affect the environment given these kind of weakened ozone layer conditions, right? So the higher elevation you go, the weaker the ozone layer gets and the more UV comes through. So we're comparing low ozone, low atmospheric conditions to high ozone back here on the surface. And we're seeing which one degrades faster, how much faster does it degrade? And we're just trying to get a good idea of everything so that we can kind of see how well our environment will handle all of this change.
I'm just wondering, so is this idea to test like, okay, if they send up some kind of equipment up in space, if they use plastic, if it would degrade faster?
So they will be holding the plastic in essentially glass vials. And so as the UV light at that high altitude passes through the plastics, it will be emitting methane gas. And they'll talk in a minute about how they are going to measure that. But Holden Suzuki, the student, was talking about how this will be kind of a look at what Earth could look like in 50 years as the ozone continues to degrade
if we don't take action and what impacts that'll have on, particularly plastics. And after the balloon flight, the students will measure the amount of methane gas that it off-gassed during the flight. But how do they do that? So Holden explains that.
This experiment was kind of a neat idea because it's a mix of like a couple different kinds of science. So obviously there's material science because of what we're dealing with and the plastics and everything. But we're also dealing with spectroscopy, which is the measure of stuff using light. So the main way that we're like actually measuring the amount of methane that we have is we're basically shooting light through it and seeing the emission and absorption lines to see how much methane and carbon there are to see how much it off-gassed. So it's kind of a unique experiment in that way that we're doing so many different things and they all kind of incorporate themselves into the total idea, because without this, we wouldn't be able to track the amount of methane. We wouldn't be able to know how much there is. Because the problem is you can't open the vials once you've sealed them, because then you're kind of losing the point of the whole research, right? So we have to find a way to measure the vials, the contents of the vials, without opening them. And that's where spectroscopy came in. And that's where some of our previous experience with physics and astronomy kind of was able to help out.
It's so fun to hear their enthusiasm and their excitement about this.
They really were fun to talk to, and they were very kind to to sort of back up and explain things to me so that, you know, I could understand them better, because as I said, their understanding of science is just so far above mine. But, you know, they carefully chose the materials, the dimensions of everything that has to fit into this tiny 4 cubic centimeter cube. And the material, as I mentioned, for the vials is borosilicate, which is a type of glass. So most vials are made of plastic, which would skew the results, right, of measuring the emissions of plastic. And so just the level of detail that they went into was really impressive. And the folks who were reviewing and selecting the applications called their proposal exceptional, and was well researched and written and demonstrated relevance and need, and they were really impressed with it. So I'm really excited to see where these students continue to follow through with their research. The team began working on the project last November, and University of Hawaii Professor of Mathematics Monique Shiba is one of the professors who has been working with the students.
I've been in touch with Cube in Space for a while. I've had a few projects that applied in the past. And after the fire on Maui, it was with a group of colleagues, we really felt that it was important to reach out to the student and provide them some opportunities. So we got actually a grant from the National Science Foundation passed in last fall, and it gave us the opportunity to fund them, to fund that experiment. We Zoomed on opportunity, but we also flew them. We've met in person, and that was really very important, I think, to show also the Hawaii resident we have the manpower on island. We have a new generation of scientists that can make a difference and that are interested and extremely bright and that are rising to solve important questions.
Oh, that's great that she's working with students. We featured her on the conversation before, but that's awesome.
It is. And the students talked about how their research could help better inform choices in government policy, as well as consumers, what type of plastics or whether they choose plastics when you are at the market, knowing the level of degradation that they will go through here as they degrade in UV light. And the students shared a lot of hope. They said, you know, in the wake of the Lahaina fires, they hope that this research will perhaps go toward climate change. As we know, you know, the high temperatures, the drought, all of those things that are contributing factors to fires. They hope that, you know, it'll just better inform those things. And they're really hopeful for the future and what their research can help with.
Well, it's so nice to hear from them. But thank you so much, Catherine.
Thank you.
That was HVR's Catherine Kluwer-Pachtel, who spent some time with Maui High School students and their test project, which is quite the science experiment.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, committed to supporting Native Hawaiian homeowners and renters impacted by the Maui wildfires. More about its Kanaho grant at oha.org/kanaho grant.
What can singing presidents in Broadway musicals tell us about how we view power? The Tony Awards are this weekend, and to commemorate the occasion, we're surveying the singing POTUSes, from the downright bizarre depictions to the real politicians pulling the strings on these productions. Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Beginning Saturday at noon.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Anchor Systems Hawaii.
Now it's time to drive through the answer to the backyard quiz. Earlier, we asked you for the name of a tunnel that runs through the Ko'olau mountain range that has gone through a couple of identity changes. Imagine how much work went into installing and reinstalling the signage that measures 5,000 feet in length. Back when the tunnels opened 30 years ago, it bore the name of the State Highways Administrator who oversaw the byway's construction. In 2001, the Kaitano administration decided to rebrand the tunnel to the John A. Burns Tunnel in honor of Hawaii's second governor. However, this did not sit well with some members in the public. After a 10,000-signature petition drive, Governor Linda Lingle restored the identity of the tunnels back to the Tetsuo Hirano, which is the answer to the backyard quiz. Friends and family were very happy to see Tetsu's name spelled out in 24-inch high aluminum letters on both sides of the mountains once again. Congrats to our winner, Gary Shive from Kaneohe. You got it right. That's today's quiz. If you have one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. This month marks 10 months since the Maui wildfires, and it will serve as an occasion to launch a music event to help with healing. The Kula Ukulele Festival, Ukuleles for Lahaina, is a special event created by the Maui Jazz and Blues Festival. It's dedicated to providing ukulele to families who lost their instruments in the fires. Maui resident Ken Bergmeyer says the idea came about because of the loss that was deeply felt by friends and family in the music world. Next week will mark the inaugural event that he hopes to take around the state.
One of my best friends and business partner, Dave Lauer, he lost his home 25 years in the Lahaina fire. And he's been living with me since August, right? And also my sound man, Dave Nakamura, his brother, passed away in the fire. And altogether, I've lost about five friends. And it's just really touched me. And then, you know, I just thought, man, how can we really help? And I just came up with, you know, we got to get ukuleles for the kids. Because all of these, they lost everything. Dave lost everything he owned. It's crazy. And it's really sad. But the ukuleles for Lahaina just came to me. And I thought, well, let's just make this all happen. And I've been doing the Lanai Ukulele Festival for years and my Big Island Maui Jazz and Blues Festivals and know a lot of the musicians. I always have ukulele artists perform for us to kind of keep that Hawaiian cultural music feel. And so we decided, hey, I reached out to a lot of my friends and we said, yeah, let's make this happen. I reached out to all the musicians and it was overwhelming with the support. And we decided, yeah, let's do it. June 22nd, we're going to do the inaugural Ukuleles for Lahaina Project, Kula Ukulele Festival. And we're going to do it at the beautiful Ocean Organic Farm and Distillery on the slopes of Haleakala. And it's one of the most beautiful venues. I do music there 7 nights a week for them. And recently, we won the best venue on Maui for music.
Nice.
And it's going to be a really great event. And we've got the Zenshin Daiko drummers are going to be coming for us. We've got Grammy-nominated and Hoku winner artists coming, like Vince Esquire's coming. Lahala Lee Park from Hana, she was the falsetto champion just a couple of years ago, and she's coming out. We have even Chase Tankayo. He was a Maui firefighter, and he was actually in Lahaina when the fires were happening. And he's been playing ukulele for me at Ocean Vodka, and And he's going to come and share his Mana'o with us. And I talked with him, and he told me stories about they were fighting that fire, how they would turn the hoses, and it would just turn to steam.
Wow.
You know, he just said, they really, it was hard.
Yeah, heartbreaking because, you know, that's their job, right? To fight fires and to protect the community. And they were just so outgunned in that fire, so overwhelmed.
Yeah, it was really sad. And, you know, forgive me, I'm kind of breaking up sometimes about this. But, and then we're going to have some other, I got from the Big Island, a Grammy nominee, great singer-songwriter, Alele Tiana. She's a really up-and-coming ukulele artist. She's fantastic. She's actually just returning back from a tour in the mainland. But she's a wonderful ukulele artist coming for us, Damaka Paoli. She's a younger, she's about 18 years old now, and really unbelievable, going to be a great superstar. She's going to play ukulele for us. I got Vene Chun. He's going to do our Pule Hawaiian blessing and play ukulele for us. He just got inducted into the Maui Hall of Fame that they just created over at the airport 2 days ago. Wow. And he's been in a couple movies. And the Hula Honeys, they're going to come and do their magic. And, of course, Benny Uitake. He's probably taught more kids ukulele over at Kalama schools here in Makawao. And he's going to bring some of his star students. And then we're going to also have Deason Kauhoelo by Banyan. And he is one of the founders of Lahaina Grown, the great band that launched their signature song and anthem of Maui, Lahaina Grown. And a lot of the band members from Lahaina Grown lost their homes as well. So he's going to be there with us and some with friends. And then Arlie Asui, ukulele band, he's going to be performing as well. And it's going to be great. We've got a little, you know, website, ukulelesforlahaina.com. We've got Chris Kamaka from Kamaka Ukuleles. He's a dear friend of mine for years. He's even going to help us out, donating a $1,500 Koa ukulele. I've got Koa Aloha involved, Mele Ukulele, Bounty Music. And we're just reaching out to the community to help us and just get ukuleles back in the hands to the kids. A lot of local businesses have really embraced it too, which is always heartwarming. And we're just going to keep doing these little projects. It's going to be the Ukulele for Lahaina project. I've already talked to the guys at Fourth Friday in Kihei. And we're going to maybe do a little event over there. We're going to take it over to Kanapali side and do a ukulele festival there. And there's even talk of us doing it on Hawaii Island and bringing it over to Oahu. And my goal is even take it to the mainland, the Ukuleles for Lahaina project. So that is what we're kind of working on. And it just came to me one night. And the Ukuleles for Lahaina just jumped out and came to me somehow.
Well, it sounds like you're putting together a very healing event for the people who are taking part in it, and then for the recipients, for the children there, for the keiki.
Yeah. You know, music is a universal and has that power to heal. You know, I'm just trying to bring the community together, and I'm just so honored to be able to make this all happen. It's a ton of work, but, you know, at the end, it's not about the work. It's about the smiles.
Well, we are marking another anniversary this month as well, and we keep all those victims in our hearts, you know, and the families who lost loved ones. But yeah, you do want to pull the community together. And we know that's happening. But this is just then what another way to do that.
Yeah. And, you know, and with you near the conversation, putting the word out for us, we really appreciate that too, especially in these times with getting press out there. Sometimes a little difficult. And we really appreciate what you guys all do, Catherine. And yeah, we want to just ask anyone, join us, help support us any way you can. It's June 22nd, the Ocean Organic Farm. It's beautiful up in Kula. And we're going to continue with this and keep getting the word out because, hey, this is something that's going to impact us forever. Lahaina will never, ever be the same. We all know that. We just got to keep going, Imua, you know, with as much aloha as we can spread.
Yes. And then what should our listeners know about tickets?
Well, we have a reservation you can call there. We know it's going to be, there's going to be a lot of people. We are doing a $5 admission. And if you can't cover the $5, don't worry, we'll get you in there, no problem. But we have a reservations line. You can go to ukulelesforlahaina.com, and you can call the Ocean Organic Farm Distillery at their 808-877-0009 number. And it's online, of course. And you can put a little reservation, come in, come on out, and it's going to be a beautiful event. It starts at 3 p.m., and it's going to go till 7:30 till sunset. We're just looking forward to giving back to the community in a new, unique way and really helping the kids and, you know, get ukuleles back into their hands. And I'm going to have kids, I want to maybe create this thing where, okay, write just a paragraph called "The Ukulele to Me Is," and have these kids in their heart write about what the ukulele is to them. You know, we just come up with a different concept, and this is our main one that we're working on now, and it's going to be a beautiful event. I can already feel it. And the response we're getting from the community has been just so loving and overwhelming.
That was Maui's Ken Bergmeier talking about his latest venture, the launch of the Ukuleles for Lahaina concert, which rolls out next weekend, June 22nd. Look for links on the conversation page of our website later today. Well, that's it for this Aloha Friday. Coming up next week, we get the wrap on FestPac 2024. This is the last weekend for the Cultural and Arts Festival, so hopefully you get a chance to take part in the many events. Have you been? What do you think? Call our talkback line and leave us your comments, 808-792-8217, or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can listen back to our shows on our website. The conversation is also available as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or Google. Our program is produced by Russell Subiono, Lillian Song, and Maddie Bender, with support from Savannah Harriman Pope. Our intern is Elisa Salcido. The Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello, and our theme music courtesy of Gypsy 808. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us Monday. Pick up the conversation.